From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In recent days, the Bush administration has exerted itself, backpedaling from pronouncements it made on the eve of war and beyond, related to the level of threat posed by Saddam Hussein. Part of the process has involved blaming the media, as when White House spokesman Scott McClellan said this week,
I think some in the media have chosen to use the word imminent. Those were not words we used.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld used it. So did McClellan's predecessor, Ari Fleischer. And actually, McClellan himself used it last February. True, the president didn't, but he did call it, among other things, a threat of unique urgency, which sounds pretty imminent to me. There are many ways in which ideas ebb and flow in the ether of the media, and we asked Hendrik Hertzberg, editor and writer for The New Yorker and former speechwriter for President Carter, to help us go through them. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I guess the most obvious way to remove ideas from the ether is to stop talking about them. And you pointed out in your article in The New Yorker recently that there were glaring omissions in the State of the Union speech.
Well, one of them, of course, was Mars, which had been the topic of the day the week previously. But when it became clear that the mission to Mars was a non-starter as far as public opinion was concerned, it was quickly dropped from the State of the Union. But of course, there are plenty of other things that were dropped from the State of the Union, too, or that never appeared. The environment, jobs, things like that.
The words we did hear, though, were pretty much related to national security. We heard war a dozen times and derivatives of terror 20 times, you counted. Do you think this is an effective way of framing the debate and keeping control over the coverage?
Well, it's an effective way of trying. It's the only way they have of trying. They want to focus the public discussion from now through the election basically on two topics. One is the war on terror and national security, and the other is the tax cuts and the theory that they have stimulated the economy. These are pretty much all the administration wants to talk about, apart from social issues, like, and to the exclusion of all others, probably gay marriage. That's the three-pronged rhetorical approach of the Bush campaign, judging from the State of the Union.
What about changing vocabulary, playing with words, moving the goalposts? This week, for instance, weapons inspector David Kay resigned, saying that he didn't believe there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq now and perhaps never were. How has the administration dealt with that?
Well, one way is, as you say, by shifting vocabulary slightly. What was once an immediate threat is now described as having been a gathering threat. It's an interesting phrase. In a way, it recalls Winston Churchill's phrase, the gathering storm, for the period before World War II. So a gathering threat is a threat that isn't quite a threat yet. And that is now how the administration is picturing Iraq as far as weapons of mass destruction are concerned. You might call it a vapor threat.
You know, Roger's thesaurus defines gathering as a direct synonym of imminent.
Well, in that case, it's even cleverer than I thought, because it seems to mean both at once, and that's the most valuable kind of word in politics.
What about obfuscation, as in the President's State of the Union reference to weapons of mass destruction program-related activities?
Yes, that's a remarkable addition to the language. It's a rhetorical dodge that was based simply on lifting a phrase directly from a David Kay report so that it would be bulletproof from criticism on the weapons of mass destruction front. But that's exactly the calculation Gore made when he talked about no controlling legal authority, a bulletproof legalism that's open to an awful lot of ridicule.
Rick, what's your take on loose cannons? When back in September of last year, there was a furor over Vice President Cheney's statement claiming a link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and he was fact-checked at the time and found to be wrong, and it seemed to be a dead and buried issue. And then last week, the vice president said this.
I continue to believe, I think there's overwhelming evidence that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government.
So what, in your mind, is a journalist to do? I mean, when does an assertion that's been disproved stop being disproved and become currency again in a war of words?
A continual reminder that there are other views of this matter, including coming from the administration, is pretty much all the press can do. At least that's all the news side of the press can do. And the press has been doing that. I don't think the press has made the mistake that it made during the Joe McCarthy era, when McCarthy's statements were simply reported without any kind of independent check on them.
But in McCarthy's day, he didn't have to contend with ubiquitous television. A statement made on television by a politician seems, at least, to trump any correctives that are offered in the pages of the nation's best newspapers.
Well, that will become increasingly less true as the political campaign continues. We've had now for the last couple of weeks, for the first time since Bush was inaugurated, voices of opposition to Bush prominent in the media, being heard regularly, and that's because of the Democratic primary campaign. And that's going to remain true at least through next November, and it changes the climate and it changes the atmosphere in which the press operates.
Are you proposing that the best corrective is a perpetual election?
Well, we have a perpetual election in this country, but we do have a one-sided conservative echo chamber in the opinion media on the electronic level anyway, and radio and cable television is mostly dominated by conservative voices. So that, combined with the control of both houses of Congress and the presidency by conservative Republicans, gives an impression of a kind of single voice coming out of Washington and the media. And that's why the election campaign, with this sudden emergence of Democrats criticizing the administration, seems so startling and new and fresh and, to some people, encouraging.
Rick Hertzberg, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Rick Hertzberg is a former speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter and currently senior editor and staff writer at The New Yorker.
For most of the Bush presidency, and especially since 9/11, the public has been eager to believe in the president, including his stated reasons for going to war in Iraq. And even when the central reason was proved to be largely groundless, a majority of the American people polls show still cling to it. Andrew Kohut is director of the Pew Research Center for People in the Press, and he routinely takes the temperature of public opinion. He joins me now to discuss how and why certain beliefs persist in the public's mind and what it takes to dislodge them. Andy, welcome back to OTM.
Happy to be with you.
Much has been made of the conspiracy theories that continue to proliferate in the Arab and Muslim worlds, for example, that the United States was behind the attacks on 9/11 and so forth. And yet, 2 years after the 9/11 attacks, a Washington Post poll found that 69% of Americans believed it was likely that Saddam Hussein had a hand in the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks. What does it take to get an idea like this lodged in the public consciousness, and what does it take to dislodge it?
I don't know, but it ain't happening. The percentage of people who think that the Saddam capture will lead to finding weapons of mass destruction, for example, is as low as 34%. But as many as 56% said it will lead to a revelation about the linkage between Saddam and al-Qaeda. This is a notion that's fixed in the minds of many Americans. Saddam has been our enemy. Al-Qaeda has become our enemy. And they both come from the same part of the world. And disconnecting them in the American mind is not easy.
Now, the Pew Center makes a living keeping its finger on the pulse of what the American public thinks about the press and the press's relationship with the government. Is there anything else striking that you found, any more misinformation or even disinformation that the public seems unwilling to let go of?
Well, there are a lot of things that the public believes that no amount of information from the press or political leaders can change. One notion is that our percentage of foreign aid is so much greater than other leading nations. Americans believe this, and when you tell people how little it actually is, it doesn't sink in.
I want to get back to the question of how these ideas get dislodged from the collective consciousness. Historically speaking, are there any assumptions that the American people have made, maybe on the basis of bad information from the government or elsewhere, that people just sort of change their minds on? And what does it take to get there?
What it takes to get there, basically, is some event which says this is no longer the case or this is not the case. Let's take the example of the war in Vietnam. Support for the war in Vietnam, despite mounting casualties, remained pretty high through 1966, 1967, and into the first 2 months of 1968. Then came the Tet Offensive, and all of a sudden we had a divided opinion on whether the war was the right thing to do. And then slowly the divided opinion was transformed into majority opposition. But it took 2.5 years and many, many casualties and high costs to get the public to change its mind. It wasn't convinced. Tet convinced it.
Presidencies have been lost. In fact, Bush presidencies have been lost when the public stops deciding to, you know, read the president's lips on an off-stated promise. I guess the risk of finally losing credibility is politically and otherwise a very serious one.
In January, CBS New York Times poll found that only 33% thought that the administration before the war was telling us what they really knew about weapons of mass destruction, down from 44% in November. And the percentage of people saying they were either hiding stuff or out and out lying has risen from 53% 2 months ago to 60% now. At this point, this credibility issue is not affecting support for the war. Right now, people are saying they weren't telling us the truth. They were exaggerating. Only 21% think they were out and out lying. But still, people think it was worth doing.
Do any of your data suggest, or do you have a sense that some sort of tipping point is approaching?
Well, we do, in fact, have 63% of people in a ABC survey at the end of the year saying we can justify this war even if we never find weapons of mass destruction. The tipping point, then, is not the absence of these weapons, but potentially the casualties getting to such an extent and such a level that people say the costs are not worth the benefits. And right now, the equation is the benefits are worth the costs.
Well, Andy, as always, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome, Bob.
Andrew Kohut is director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press.
Coming up, Lord Hutton blames the BBC and why our government's right to keep secrets may be based on a 50-year-old fraud.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week in London, Lord Hutton declared the BBC the loser in its long-running battle with the government of Tony Blair. Last year, BBC reporter Andrew Gilligan charged the Blair government with, quote, sexing up documents to bolster its case for the war in Iraq. The government was outraged, but the BBC stood by its story, and the network's alleged source, government scientist David Kelly, killed himself in the wake of the scandal. The Hutton inquiry was convened to find the guilty party. It found the BBC.
The allegations that Mr. Gilligan was intending to broadcast in respect of the government and the preparation of the dossier were very grave allegations in relation to a subject of great importance. And I consider that the editorial system which the BBC permitted was defective, in that Mr. Gilligan was allowed to broadcast his report at 6:07 a.m. without editors having seen a script of what he is going to say and having considered whether it should be approved.
In the wake of Lord Hutton's conclusion, the BBC's chairman, Gavin Davis, and Director General, Greg Dyke, resigned. Later, more than 1,000 BBC employees walked out protesting Dyke's resignation. Meanwhile, the BBC's acting chairman, Lord Ryder, issued an apology on behalf of the Board of Governors.
I have no hesitation in apologizing unreservedly for our errors and to the individuals whose reputations were affected by them.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb has been monitoring reactions to the Hutton report from London.
I think that what Lord Hutton didn't take into account in his very narrow judicial remit was the long-standing dynamic between the BBC and British governments of either political stripe. The BBC is always relied on by the government in a country where most of the press is nakedly partisan to be very straightforward. And of course, it always disappoints each government because governments think, well, the BBC should sort of be giving our message unfiltered to the people. For years before the Iraq War, the BBC was a constant recipient of criticism from Downing Street. And so when it finally happened that Andrew Gilligan made these sexed up claims about the government's use of intelligence going to war, the BBC dug in its heels and said, well, you know, you just can't push us around. And of course, fatally, this was an instance where a BBC journalist had made an error, and by the time they got around to investigating it, processes had been set in motion that ultimately led to David Kelly's suicide.
Well, there seems to be a subtext here with the resignations. The BBC response seems to be, well, Lord Hutton, thank you very much. We're abashed, of course, and all the appropriate leaders will fall on their swords. But, of course, you really don't understand the context. And, by the way, you don't really understand how journalism works, do you? Are you sensing that kind of response from the BBC?
The BBC has been excessively, I think, fair and really looked at itself with great scrutiny. The rest of the British press, however, has taken to calling this a whitewash. The Independent newspaper, the day after the Hutton report was published, above the fold, it was all white except for one small headline that said whitewash. And then below the fold, it was an editorial saying that Lord Hutton had missed the point. Interestingly enough, if Tony Blair had wanted the judgment of Lord Hutton to end his misery, it hasn't, because the press, I think, will probably be even more aggressive in trying to find out why there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and how it came to be that the case for war was built on the fact that the intelligence seemed to indicate that there was.
Now, as you read the press in England, putting aside the question of whitewash, is there an overall sense that Lord Hutton's report was somehow fundamentally naive, that he just simply doesn't understand how journalism is accomplished and the relationship between the BBC and the government?
The general feeling is this man is an establishment judge. So they sort of knew what they were going to get, and not unsurprisingly, the establishment judge found that more or less the civil service and the government behaved honorably. But the amazing thing is that Gavin Davies, who resigned as the chairman of the Board of Governors, and Greg Dyke, who resigned as director general, were both members of that establishment. Gavin Davies' wife actually works for Gordon Brown, who's chancellor of the Exchequer and the anointed successor to Tony Blair. And yet, these two men and Downing Street were somehow not able to make a private personal call to just cool off temperatures. I mean, the one argument in favor of a closed establishment is at least gentlemen of a like mind can sit around and have a whiskey and sort the problems of the world. But in this case, gentlemen of a like mind ended up having this enormous ego contest.
I want to ask you about the lasting effects. The Beeb, it isn't merely a network. It is an institution in the United Kingdom, kind of like the monarchy, I suppose, because it's resented and revered at the same time. What do you think the impact will be on the standing of the BBC for the British public?
Well, it's really interesting, Bob, that you should choose the monarchy, because it is an institutional part of British society, the BBC. But rather like the monarchy, it needs to modernize. And yet, if you were to hold a referendum on turning Britain into a republic, a modern society, people would still vote to keep their monarch in place. Same with the BBC. People complain about it all the time. They pay a tax to sustain it. Yet if you were to say, we're going to eliminate the BBC, I think there'd be a huge outcry in this country. The BBC is a cultural reflection of the British. And perhaps you could even say Britain's always difficult encounters with modernization are simply reflected in the BBC.
All right, Michael. Well, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Michael Goldfarb of WBUR reported to us from London.
In October of 1948, an Air Force plane crashed in Georgia. 9 men died, among them 4 civilians, and 3 of their widows sued. The government argued that releasing documents related to their deaths would jeopardize national security, and it won. In U.S. versus Reynolds, a new and enduring legal precedent was set by the Supreme Court. The government obtained the right to apply what's known as the state secrets privilege. But now U.S. versus Reynolds is being challenged. The children of the dead finally have had a look at those half-century-old documents and say they found no reference to anything that relates to national security. They charge the government with a cover-up, and in so doing, suggest that the case that underpins the government's right to keep so many secrets is based on a fraud. Joining me is Jonathan Turley, a professor at George Washington University Law School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what actually was the precedent that U.S. v. Reynolds set?
What the court said was that trial judges needed to consider privilege arguments by the government. But the court also said that courts should struggle to remove only that evidence that clearly would violate national security. And the court talked about other ways that judges could allow evidence to come in. So the case itself really didn't give a hint of what it would become, because over the decades that followed, courts began to simply allow the privilege to be used almost unilaterally. A lot of district judges, frankly, don't want the headache of national security cases. And so when the government comes in with a silver bullet and says dismiss the whole case, a lot of judges are not complaining much.
And is it seen as a silver bullet generally in the legal community or just by government lawyers?
Well, frankly, when United States Reynolds comes around, you pretty much know the government's on the ropes. This is the thing that they pull out when their case is not going well or they found something enormously embarrassing in the file. I've actually been in a courtroom where Reynolds was invoked and people laughed. They actually invoked the privilege over a manual that was reportedly available on the internet, and reporters in the room were literally holding them up so the judge could see.
And the judge still went with the government.
Yes.
Well, let's go back to the original case. In Reynolds, the plaintiffs here are charging, the courts could have seen that the government was lying about its national security significance if it wanted to, and it simply chose to ignore it.
I think that is true, that the Supreme Court acted in what can only be viewed as willful blindness. At the time, it was abundantly clear to many that the Air Force was lying, that they could in fact produce this information, if not in the direct report, in a summary of the report. So then in 2000, when finally these memos appear, we have this line in the memo saying the aircraft is not considered to have been safe for flight. That was the conclusion of the report. Now, even if they had redacted the entirety of the report so that the basis of that conclusion is hidden, they should have at least produced that conclusion.
But the courts at the time decided that that report could be kept secret, and now we have Reynolds today. And how has it been applied in the prosecution of the government's war on terror?
Attorney General Ashcroft took every possible case to muster in support of his national security efforts. Well, Reynolds was ready-made for that. And now Reynolds has virtually become a stamp. I mean, any case that involves remotely the military or national security or, you know, poultry regulations, any type of civil liberties claim that's been brought since 9/11 has run right into Reynolds. And the government's come forward and said, look, we can't tell you whether we're beating detainees because it would reveal state secrets. Well, that's bloody ridiculous. I mean, if you're asking about whether detainees have been beaten, you're asking about whether a crime has occurred. That's not a matter of national security. It's a matter of criminal law.
So let's return to the current challenge to Reynolds, which is called Herring versus the United States. Where does it stand?
Well, the daughter of one of the engineers on that fateful flight uncovered this smoking gun, if you will, where the memo, which had no national security components but a heck of a lot of embarrassing stuff to say about the Air Force, they filed with the Supreme Court and said, look, it appears that you were lied to. You created a whole doctrine on an act of deception. Well, not surprisingly, the Supreme Court declined to take it up. This is an enormous embarrassment for them as an institution. They then filed in the federal district court. And once again, the Justice Department is moving to dismiss that action. The troubling thing about these filings is the apparent lack of recourse when you find that the government lied, not in a small way, but in a way that created this massive doctrine. And if the district court dismisses this action, then there really isn't any deterrent to the government from lying. I mean, even when you can wave around a memo in which they clearly misled the Supreme Court of the United States, there's no recourse. Well, that's going to send one hell of a message to Justice Department attorneys.
Jonathan Turley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Turley is a professor at George Washington University Law School.
In Rome, the eyes of the world are focused on Pope John Paul II. Now well into his ninth decade. And though he shows signs of Parkinson's disease and fatigue, his pace hasn't slowed much. In recent days, he told Vice President Cheney that the U.S. must work for peace, expressed alarm over the drop in French priests, and called for more unity within the Catholic Church, and evidently blessed breakdancing. But the world still awaits his demise, including two infamous British bookies who this month offered odds on the Pope's successor. Also waiting, as Megan Williams reported a year ago, are the media, and nothing much has changed.
It's not something the Vatican or media outlets want to talk about, but for the past several years, preparations for the Pope's death have been moving along at a fast clip. Television networks from around the world have been caught in bidding wars for balconies that provide the prized shot of St. Peter's Square. When the Pope dies, the cardinals gather in the Sistine Chapel to elect a new one. Once he's chosen, a plume of black smoke lifting out of St. Peter's will turn white. This is to let the world know there's a new Pope, and it's the shot that TV networks are willing to pay a lot of money for. Robert Mickens is a Vatican specialist. He's covered the Pope for the past 10 years, much of that at Vatican Radio. Mickens says that all the nervous gearing up for the Pope's death has been going on for about a decade. But with each passing year, the tension increases, along with the price the networks are paying to secure a good shot of St. Peter's.
Right from the very beginning, I mean, already back in 93, this whole thing, the Death Watch started, and people, the news networks, big media, started looking for spaces to do their setup for the whole event, which is going to be a couple of weeks long from the time he dies, the funeral, and then the conclave. Because, I mean, this is a whole package deal, and they want to be on site for that. So you've got people that already were paying a yearly deposit just to reserve a balcony or a rooftop of a nice hotel with St. Peter's in the background for that day when the Pope is sick and dies so they can set up.
Networks themselves won't disclose how much they're paying, nor will landlords who have been sworn to secrecy. But Tommaso De Benedetti, a journalist for the Italian daily Il Mattino, says that most of the balconies are going for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And one that directly overlooks St. Peter's Square has gone to a major U.S. network for a whole lot more.
One network pays $2 million for 3 days of a balcony. The balcony is looking over St. Peter's Square. Cost $2 million for 3 days. And that is sure.
But the preparations don't stop with location. Media networks are lining up Vatican experts to provide round-the-clock commentary during the funeral and conclave.
It will be near 9/11 in terms of levels of coverage, but not just in the States, but internationally. I mean, it becomes the biggest story in the world for roughly a month. And obviously, you know, media outlets want to be ready for it.
John Allen is author of the recently published book called The Conclave. He's also just signed a hefty contract with CNN to be its commentator during the funeral and conclave. He says true Vatican experts like himself are few and far between. It's a difficult beat to cover. The Vatican is renowned for its arcane language and bureaucracy, as well as blocking access to the media. So people like Allen, who know their way around, come at a premium.
But to put it crassly, we have a seller's market these days for Vatican expertise because, you know, people are obviously fascinated by the question of what might happen when this pope dies. Who might be the next pope, and how will that pope get chosen, and how does this mysterious centuries-old process really work, and what are the politics, you know, beneath the smoke and mirrors? And so what it has meant is that I find myself much busier than I was at this time, say, 2 years ago.
Not only are experts like Alan being called upon to comment, most have lucrative book contracts. Alan himself will have to turn around a biography of the new pope within weeks. He says he's done his homework and isn't worried about pulling it off, but he is concerned about all the competition.
I can speak with confidence in the English-speaking world. Every publisher I know has someone lined up to do a biography of the new pope when it happens. So there will be a flood of these titles. And the logic there is there will be a few months when anything with the new pope's picture on it is going to fly off shelves.
And a number of publishers have already hedged their bets by putting out books before the pope has died. Even John Allen has a section in The Conclave outlining the top contenders for the job. This is risky. Several on his list died as the book was being printed. And as Robert Mickens points out, so far this pope has defied the odds.
And then the whole thing just is, as his health has deteriorated, people have been making this guessing game. I think it's interesting that Peter Hebblethwaite wrote a book right around the same time called The Next Pope. Well, Peter Hebblethwaite died. And so, I mean, the pope should have wrote a book called The Next Hebblethwaite, and it would have made more sense.
Sit down, Domine Benedictum.
Ex hoc nunc et usque in saeculum.
Adiutorium nostrum in nomine Domini.
Qui fecit caelum et terra.
Benedicat vos, omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius, Spiritus Sanctus.
Amen.
For On the Media, this is Megan Williams in Rome.
Coming up, election night coverage hints at the news, and if reality TV picked presidents.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. We had a lot of reaction to my commentary that likened the Dean scream to the Wilhelm movie howl. I criticized the media for taking that campaign moment out of context, but according to Fred Kyle, I was also guilty. He writes, I usually enjoy your show, but I turned this one off in disgust after the 14th replay of Howard Dean's scream. I am not a Dean supporter, but I thought I was watching Fox News. Very poor taste, I thought. Once or twice would have been okay, but I bet you replayed his scream 25 or 30 times.
Actually, it was 4. But Bob Hart of Lee, New Hampshire, was among those who were intrigued with the commentary. He writes, Dean's scream sure was like blood in the water to all the sharks that surround the field of candidates. When I heard you play back the now infamous scream, I wondered if it really was Dean or the Wilhelm. No doubt some movie sound engineer will have a laugh by using Dean's in a movie. Keep your ears peeled.
Michael Antonoff of New York City writes to point out a serious omission in our discussion about the broadcast of the State of the Union address. OTM failed to note that this was the first State of the Union to be broadcast in high definition. The pool feed was carried by ABC, NBC, and CBS on their digital stations. Greater image detail in the widescreen picture made you feel like you were there. A missed opportunity, though, was not using surround sound. If the State of the Union had been properly mic'd and broadcast with discrete audio channels, we could have noted the overwrought applause coming from the right and the deafening silence from the left. Maybe next year.
We hope we hear from you before then. Write us at onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
New Hampshire voters finally went to the polls this week, and while they voted, the rest of us watched and waited.
Good evening. Voting places here in the first presidential primary of Campaign 04 will be open just a little while longer, till 8 Eastern time. So we can't tell you, we don't yet know in what order the Democratic candidates will finish. But we can tell you about the voters, including how they chose a candidate.
Contrast Dan Rather's somber commitment to journalistic responsibility last Tuesday with his and all the other networks' performance on election night 2000. Few will forget the image of Rather being forced to eat his words after calling Florida for Gore and assuring viewers that they could take that to the bank. So this time around, the networks are being extra careful not to announce winners and losers until all the polls have closed, even though they have access to exit poll data much earlier than that. But political junkies fear not. Andrew Tyndall, who tracks nightly newscasts and dissects them in the Tyndall Report, says a careful watcher can still scope out the winner as early as 6:30. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let me play some tape from CBS, The Evening News with Dan Rather, and tell me what's afoot here, please.
Heading into today, there wasn't a poll out there that had Kerry less than 11 points ahead in a race many voters here said was about one thing. Who can beat George Bush?
We will not give up!
Dean, who needs at least a second here after whooping himself out of the front-runner spot after Iowa.
I feel very good. I feel some room, very positive, good about how things are going.
Edwards, looking for momentum, headed back to his native South Carolina. And Clark are all battling for a bounce from New Hampshire.
Now, that seems very straightforward, Andrew. They're sort of kind of recapitulating the opinion polls going into Election Day. What's so odd about that?
Nothing's so odd about it. The point is that they did their own exit polls during the vote. If there had been any surprises that they knew about 90 minutes before the polls had closed, they wouldn't have said it in that order. That order, it turns out to be almost an exact prediction of what the result of the election was, right down to saying that Kerry was 11 points ahead of Dean, and I think he won by 13, didn't he?
What a fabulous coincidence, and what good fortune for CBS. ABC did things a slightly different way. Let's listen to some tape from World News Tonight with Peter Jennings.
The Kerry campaign strategy now, Peter, is to build on any strength that they may have here in New Hampshire, to build more exposure, to try to get more support in those seven states that vote next week.
Many thanks, Kate. Kate Snow up with us in New Hampshire. Here, Governor Dean may have pleased many of his supporters today when he criticized the news media for so much coverage devoted to the speech he gave at a rally after he lost in Iowa. Tonight, his campaign here is very focused on coming back. Here's ABC's Dan Harris.
Okay, now, what Jennings did to tip you off as to the result was he placed the reports from the individuals who are filing from the campaigns in a particular order. Turned out that the order was the order of finish in the primary.
And what about NBC?
And NBC, instead of doing one on Kerry, then one on Dean, and then mentioning the also-rans, they did one on Kerry and Dean, Kerry the front-runner, Dean coming from behind, and then another one on the three also-rans. All you've got to do is watch the rundown and you can predict the result.
Let's just say that many viewers will be able to divine from the way these returns are coming in who's ahead and who is sucking wind. But let's just look at the wisdom of this game of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. What's the argument for doing it this way versus the argument for just simply being straightforward with the data that you have come what may?
Because strictly speaking, the polls are still open and voters can theoretically watch the news and either be discouraged or encouraged to vote, so they can be influencing the vote by reporting the news.
But if the code is so easy to break, wouldn't the news or the subtext of the news be just as discouraging to a prospective voter as the results of some exit poll?
You know, I sat down beforehand to watch all three of these evening newscasts on Tuesday night before I knew the results of the election. Once I'd seen all three of them, I could break the code. I don't think looking at one of them on their own live without videotape, it would be that easy to break. Now, of course, now you've listened to me explain the code, it's going to be really easy to break.
All right, South Carolina is coming up. Nobody really knows who's going to win that. What shall we look for in the teasers that open the evening news broadcasts on Tuesday that will tell us who won before we really get started?
Which state they lead with. Because they've already started saying, not so much South Carolina, let's look at Missouri instead. Let's look at Arizona, et cetera, et cetera. Between now and next Tuesday, we're going to know which states individual candidates are running strong in. And the decision which state to emphasize is going to tell us which candidate is winning or losing the expectations game.
So give me a headline that could theoretically open the CBS Evening News Tuesday that would mean Howard Dean is back.
Arizona, the online state where youth is active, scores a major upset in Tuesday's primaries.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Tindall runs the Tindall Report, a New York-based company that monitors the network's nightly newscasts. Starting this month, you can go online to check your email, pay your bills, enlarge your penis, or begin your own presidential candidacy. Showtime Television has officially launched its American Candidate website and is accepting applications. Those applications will be narrowed down to 12 contestants who will compete reality television style to be the first American candidate. In Showtime's 10-episode primary, nobody will have to start fires or eat bugs, but contestants will nonetheless have to run the humiliating and degrading gauntlet called candidacy. Emmy Award-winning and Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker R.J. Cutler, maker of The War Room and American High, is behind this operation. He joins me now from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. R.J., welcome back to On the Media.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Tell me the eureka moment, presidential race as reality television. Where did this idea come from?
In the wake of the 2000 presidential election, I was approached by my executive producing partners, Jay Roach and Tom LaSalle, who were responding to this sense that you have a lot of people in this country who are simply not participating in the process. Well, why is that? There was a eureka moment kind of in the wake of the success of American Idol when we were all sitting around with Kevin Riley, who was then the head of the cable network FX. And Kevin said, have you ever thought about doing it American Idol style, where people voted on a weekly basis and eliminated one person after another? And that kind of triggered the current form of the show, which is a weekly show. Now, the show is very much not going to be like American Idol. It's meant really to be a giant simulation of a presidential election, and it will be.
Well, I want to talk about that moment, though. When Kevin Riley uttered those words, did everybody laugh?
Oh, of course.
But then you got thinking, didn't you?
Of course. Well, quite frankly, in that moment, I had the same reaction that I think we've seen replicated, you know, every time the show has been announced or spoken about in the press or wherever. There is something about the nexus of presidential politics, television, a competition culture, reality television, all of those things that are, when you put them together, it's surprisingly revelatory. It touches a nerve. Very early on, when we first announced we were working on this show, I was doing an interview with somebody on television, and the first question she asked was, do you mean to tell me that television is going to be involved in the selection of the next president of the United States? And, of course, my reaction was, well, yes,
when was
television
it?
Will be involved. That's right.
Let me borrow her righteous indignation, if not her literal yes. question, by asking you, why isn't this a trivialization of the democratic process?
Well, certainly it could be. Or you could say, look, we're going to take everything we do very, very seriously. And we're going to draw the curtain back and show how the process really works. We're going to show just how challenging it is to run for president. We're going to show the difficult decisions that have to be made between your convictions and what is politically expedient. We're going to show how polling works. We're going to show how opposition research works. We're going to show all of those things. We also want to have a perspective on presidential politics. We want to be able to illuminate its more absurd qualities, that we want to be able to reflect upon the role that the media plays. We want to ask questions about what we're looking for in a presidential candidate.
Tell me mechanically how it's all going to work.
The mechanics have begun already. We've received thousands of requests for applications. Anybody who qualifies under the Constitution to run for president is eligible to be on our show.
Well, you and your partners are, in effect, the smoke-filled room that's going to determine the pool of candidates. What are you looking for in that pool?
We want everybody who tunes into the show to have somebody whose vision resonates with them and excites them. So we will put together a diverse group and introduce them to the viewing public this summer. And then the process will begin, and our candidates will crisscross the country. Each week we'll be in a different town. The process will begin as a retail process where the emphasis is on going door-to-door and meeting people and caucus-like events. And as the weeks go on and the field is narrowed, the process will be more of a wholesale process, and the emphasis will be more on media and advertising and large-scale debates. The candidates on our show will have access to seasoned political strategists. They'll have access to opposition research on themselves. At a certain point, they'll have to choose a running mate. In every way, our goal is to emulate what happens in an actual presidential campaign.
Allow me to end, please, with a compound hypothetical. If the winner of American Candidate emerges to actually seek public office, and if that person does wind up eventually in the Oval Office, and if that person turns out to be a nightmare president of the United States, Dr. Frankenstein, what will you do?
You know, we've elected all sorts of people to the highest office in this land, and all sorts of people to the Congress, to the Senate. I don't fear that we're going to do worse through a process that identifies people outside of the political class.
R.J. Cutler, thank you very much.
It's certainly my pleasure.
Filmmaker R.J. Cutler is creator and executive producer of American Candidate, to air on Showtime this summer. To learn more about American Candidate, click on www.americancandidate.com.
And this week in media, a death and a departure. The death was Jack Parr's, who created something new and exciting when TV was just a baby. He did it in one of broadcasting's crystal palaces, The Tonight Show, where he reigned from 1957 to 1962 between the monarchies of entertainer Steve Allen and comedian Johnny Carson. Parr was neither, really. He was just a curious guy who was impressed by talent and subject to mood swings, more or less like us, or how we might have been in the 50s. He lived on Earth, and he wanted his guests to join him there because he thought Earth was a wonderful place and because that was a side of celebrities that people like us didn't get to see.
I have noticed that if you watch political programs, they are asked political questions, and the answers are political answers. And sometimes, I must say, I watch shows for a half hour, and when it's all over, no one said anything when it's all over. But there is a chance that in this relaxed atmosphere of The Tonight Show, you can meet people who aren't on guard, not as tense, and perhaps not as political as you would meet them on other news-type shows.
So he didn't distinguish among the different flavors of fame. He had personal chats with rising stars and established ones, and with the most powerful people on Earth, John F. Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Fidel Castro.
Very late in Havana, Cuba, and Fidel Castro has just come down from his suite in the Havana Hilton after days and days and days of little sleep and some sadness which happened to him, personal sadness in Venezuela. And I'm very happy that he came down from his suite right upstairs to talk to me tonight. Mr. Castro, I can say, not as a politician, I have no right to talk of politics, I'm an entertainer, but as an old friend of Cuba, not a newcomer, 5 years I've been coming here and speaking of Cuba, you are a good neighbor to me personally. You live right up there. Does he understand? And you're not noisy. And you're not noisy. And you have not come down to borrow any sugar. You have been a good neighbor.
Okay.
And I know how tired you are, and I know how many questions you've been asked.
Mind, you can ask all that you want for the public opinion of the United States about anything that you want.
Today, that might sound like pandering, but back then, his probing for humanity was a revelation. Now that's practically all there is, which brings us to this week's significant media departure. After a quarter of a century, ABC's Barbara Walters is leaving her perch at 2020. Walters is the modern master of the personal probe. She's applied it to nearly every famous figure of our day, from John Wayne to Hillary Clinton.
You're right. I could hardly breathe. I started crying and yelling at him. What are you saying? Why did you lie to me? What did your husband say? How did he explain it?
He just kept saying that he was very sorry, over and over again. And I could tell that he was, but that wasn't much comfort. I was still furious and stayed furious for quite some time. But he just kept saying over and over again, you know, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Walters was both loathed and admired for posing questions we wouldn't dare to ask. But she was stunningly successful, and her signature style spawned a generation of ham-handed imitators. Witness Diane Sawyer's recent sit-down with the doctor's dean. Watching guests quail under such sledgehammer questioning, we pity the subjects, hate the journalists, and are embarrassed for ourselves. Such journalistic excess has its roots in Jack Parr's gentle innovation, but he was no journalist. Walters' trademark moment was to wait quietly while her subjects wept over remembered pain. Parr did not elicit tears, but if he had, he probably would have cried along with his guest. He didn't sit in silent judgment on private lives, as journalists often do.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Derek John and the entire engineering staff of NPR West. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.